Now, we learned in the first week that God created everything, that he made humankind in his image, and that humanity rebelled, and that brought sin into the world, which corrupted everything. It corrupted our relationship with one another. It corrupted our relationship with the creation God created us to rule over. It ruined our relationship between us and God. And humanity from that point has been struggling against sin. We see that even in ourselves today, but we saw from the very first moment, from the very first instance of sin, that God had a plan of restoring his creation back to himself, that through the offspring of the woman who had sinned, one would come who would crush the head of the serpent, who would be the one who overcame the reign of sin and death on the world. Now, last week, we saw God put this plan into motion by choosing this man, Abram, which he later calls Abraham. And God makes these promises to Abraham so that he would use Abraham's family as part of his plan, as part of restoring the world back to him. Now, last week, we had a memory verse that was actually God's initial promise to Abraham. Do you think you remember the memory verse? We did really well last time, like 10 out of 10 last time. This one's a little bit longer. We'll see how we do. I'm going to cover my notes. You can close your storybook and your Bible, and we'll see how this goes. It's Genesis 12:2. You ready? I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I saw some mouths moving. All right, we're good. We're good. That's fine. That's fine. We'll keep working on those. But we see God making these huge promises to Abraham, right? He and his wife couldn't have kids, but God promised they would have as many kids as there are stars in the sky or dust on the earth. They were people that God asked to leave their homeland, and God said, I will give you and your descendants a brand new homeland. And he told them that he would bless the nations through Abraham and his family. No one really knew or worshiped God at that time, and God was making himself known through Abraham and his family. Ultimately, God's plan of redemption was to bring his Messiah through the descendants of Abraham, who would come and destroy the reign of sin and death in God's creation. Now, if you did your reading this week, you'll know that the story didn't end with Abraham, that he had a son, Isaac. And Isaac married a woman named Rebecca, and they had two sons, Jacob and Esau. And throughout their life, Jacob and Esau were fighting back and forth. Jacob was kind of a swindler, and he made a deal, and he got what his brother should have inherited, kind of a messed up guy. And he actually ends up wrestling with God, and God blesses him and changes his name from Jacob to Israel. That's where we get the nation of Israel. Israel ended up having 12 sons from four different wives. That's a whole other issue that we won't even get at this morning. But he has 12 sons, which become the 12 tribes of Israel. And this week, our story zooms in on one of those 12 sons, Joseph. Now, you've probably heard of the story of Joseph forever memorialized in the Broadway musical Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. There's movies, there's all this stuff, kids' books. It's one of those stories that you hear all the time because there's the fancy colored coat. Now, Joseph was the second youngest son of Israel, but he was his favorite son, because he was the first son born to Israel's favorite wife. That's a whole other issue. We won't get into the polygamy thing. That's kind of messed up. But he liked Joseph more than any of his other sons, so much that he made him this ornate robe, right? This beautiful technicolor dream coat, however you want to call it. But Joseph, as one commentator I read this week, he was a bit of a snot-nosed punk. He was the kind of guy who, he let his brothers know that he was the favorite one, right? He went around parading in his multicolored, technicolored dream coat, ornate robe. And he also had a few dreams. he had this one dream where there was these 12 shafts of grain, and they were all bowing down to this one upright chaff of grain. And so he went and he told his brothers this story, and they're like, you really think that we're going to bow down to you? Like, it's kind of obvious what you're getting at, Joseph. Like, we already know you're the favorite son. You don't have to start rubbing it in now saying you've got dreams that we're all going to bow down to you. Then he has a dream that the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to him. And he tells his parents, and his dad's like, you realize you're not helping yourself out here, right? Like, me and your mom and your 11 brothers bowing down to you. Like, come on, man. Like, cool it down a little bit. Joseph was one of those guys where, like, he knew something, but it shouldn't have been said. You know what I mean? Husbands, like, you have that moment where, like, there's something that comes to mind. You just know you shouldn't say it because it would not help your situation at all. Like, that is, Joseph just did not have that filter. He was not helping his case. And finally, Joseph's brothers had had enough. And we see sin working in their hearts. We see this pattern of brother fighting against brother throughout Genesis. And they finally had enough, where one day when Israel sent Joseph to go check in on the other brothers who were looking over, watching his flocks in a few towns over, they decided to plot against him when they see him coming on the horizon. Oh, here he comes. They decided to put an end to his foolishness and dreams. We read about it in Genesis 37, page 29 and 30, if you're in your storybook. This is Genesis 37, verse 20. And the brothers said to one another, here comes the dreamer, come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns, one of these pits or wells, and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. Now, luckily for Joseph, Reuben, his oldest brother, was like, I don't want any blood on my hands. Let's just, like, throw him in the cistern. And he had a thought, like, I'm just going to, like, take him back to dad, because I know how much dad likes this guy, and I don't want to upset dad. But then Judah, he sees some Ishmaelite traders coming by, and he's like, let's make some money out of this. So they kidnap their brother. They throw him in the cistern. And then they decide, once these travelers come, let's sell him. They're on their way to Egypt. Make some money out of this. And so they sell their brother to these Ishmaelite traveling salesmen headed for Egypt. They had to come up with a way of, how do we explain to dad what we did? So, like they said, they staged it like he was attacked by an animal. They dipped his coat in goat's blood and brought it back to their dad and said that their son was attacked by a wild animal. And it wrecked Israel. It wrecked the man. He was inconsolable. He goes on to say that, I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave. And we see from this moment forward, he, as a man, is different because of the death of his favorite son. Now, meanwhile, these Ishmaelite traders, they get to Egypt and they sell Joseph to a man named Potiphar. And Potiphar was an official. He oversaw the guard of Egypt. He was a high up ranking guy. He's the kind of guy who would have a ton of slaves at the time. But here's something interesting that we read. In Genesis 39, verses 2 to 5, page 31 of your storybook, we read this, that even though Joseph was sold into slavery, God was with him. This is 39, verse 2. It says, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted him to care for everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. God was with him even though he was sold into slavery. God was helping him out, helping him to see, have favor with his master, helping him to flourish even as a slave. But before too long, things take a turn for the worse. You know things are going to go bad when the very next paragraph says, "Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph. And she tried to entice Joseph to come and commit adultery with her. And she was fairly persistent in this. And Joseph was like, no, I'm not going to do that. It's a sin against God. It's disobeying my master. I've got too much responsibility to get messed up in this kind of mess." And what she does, sneakily enough, is as he's running away, she grabs his cloak from him. And he runs and gets away, but she cries out and she has his cloak as evidence for her story, where she tells her husband that this slave of his tried to assault her. And so Potiphar, believing his wife's story, takes Joseph and throws him in prison to rot, strips him of his position and responsibilities. But even though Joseph was in prison, we read again of God with him. This is in 39 down in verse 20, page 32 in your storybook. It says, "But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did." You know what strikes me? Like, throughout this story, the author of Genesis is really making a point. You see this pattern, right? Like, Joseph really gets the short end of the stick. He gets sold into slavery, but God's with him and gives him favor and uses him in that role. He gets falsely accused and thrown in prison, but God is with him and gives him favor and uses him in that role. We see something beautiful about God's faithfulness here. Remember, God promised to be faithful to Abraham and his descendants. He made a covenant with them. We see God's faithfulness with him even in the midst of slavery and imprisonment. And while Joseph was in prison, God gave Joseph the ability to interpret the dreams of two of Pharaoh's officials who weren't really in his good books at the time. They both had these dreams, and Joseph, by the power of God, was able to interpret these dreams. There was something about dreams with Joseph. The baker and the cupbearer of Pharaoh. Eventually, Joseph's ability to interpret these dreams of Pharaoh's servants would lead him to his big break, when Pharaoh himself is haunted by dreams that no one seems to be able to interpret. He hears of this man in prison, this slave, who is able to interpret the dreams of his servants. And he brings him in, and this is the dream that he has. That there's these seven beautiful cows, big, fat, would feed a ton of people. These seven beautiful cows come up out of the Nile River in Egypt, only to be eaten by seven ugly, gaunt, skinny cows. And then quickly followed by these seven flourishing, rich, full heads of grain, only to be devoured by seven skinny, no good, spoiled heads of grain. And no one could interpret this dream for him. He's like, what is going on? This is reoccurring. This is haunting me. But just like God gave Joseph the ability to interpret the dreams of the baker and the cupbearer, just like God gave Joseph favor with the prison warden and with Potiphar, he gave Joseph the ability to interpret Pharaoh's dream. And this is what he says. He says that there will be 7 years of great harvest in Egypt, that you're going to get more than enough for the next 7 years. But after that, there's going to be 7 years of devastating famine, a famine like you've never seen before. And God, in his mercy, knew this was coming and was warning you. So what you should do is you should get someone in a position of authority to ration out the food, so we know that in these years of plenty, there will be enough for the 7 years of devastating famine. That's what you need to do. That's what this dream is. Needless to say, Pharaoh was impressed and he decided to make Joseph this chief executive of making sure there was enough food. And this is what he says to him in chapter 41, verses 39 and 40, page 33 of your storybook. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." I find it amazing that Pharaoh acknowledges the creator God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph as the one who is saving Egypt in the midst of this. And so he appoints Joseph. We need to take a step back here and remind ourselves of God's big upper story, right? Remind ourselves that God has decided that through the descendants of Abraham, he was going to bless the nations. He was going to make himself known to the world. He said, "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you so that you will bless the nations." God's plan was to make himself known to them, to the world through them. And how much more known can you get than being acknowledged by Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the greatest empire the world had ever seen at that time, as the God who is able to interpret his dreams and save his country? How much more of a blessing can you be than to save thousands of lives by warning them of this impending, devastating famine? God knew this famine was coming, and in his mercy, he's been at work to save Egypt. But not only Egypt. Just as God promised to remain faithful to Abraham and his descendants, God uses Joseph to save his own family. Once the famine actually hits, the only place in that part of the Middle East that has any kind of grain or good harvest is Egypt. And so people come from all over to Egypt to get what they need to be able to survive. So even Joseph's brothers, his father Israel, they need to eat. And Israel sends his 10 sons down to Egypt to buy grain. He keeps his youngest son, Benjamin, back with him, the other son who was born of his favorite wife, Joseph's only younger brother. He'd already lost Joseph, and it devastated him for years, even decades later. He wasn't going to let Benjamin get lost either. Now, I just have a quick slide here just to give you a picture of where this is. So Canaan is the land that Israel and his family were living in. And Egypt, there's the Nile Delta and the Nile River there to the left of the Red Sea. That's a pretty good trek going from Canaan to Egypt and back. They had to travel to Egypt for this. And remember, the whole time, the family still thinks that Joseph is either dead or some beaten down slave somewhere building pyramids or something. They had no idea what had been transpiring over the past decades to bring Joseph to the position he was in. But God lined these things up in such a way that Joseph himself was the man in charge of providing the grain for the hungry when his own brothers who had betrayed him come looking for help. Now, we need to remember that Joseph still has a little bit of that snot-nosed punk left in him. It wasn't totally beaten out of him over the years. He's still got sin at work in his heart. So over the next couple chapters, what we see him do is, as he sees his brothers coming, he's like, I'm going to mess with them a little bit. He's had things festering in his heart over the years of being betrayed by his brothers, of being sold into slavery, of being falsely accused and imprisoned. It was time for him to give them a taste of their own medicine. He's going to play with them a little bit. So when they come, they ask Joseph to buy grain. They have no idea that it's him. But he says, I see that there's only 10 of you. Don't you have, or I hear that you have a younger brother. I am going to keep Simeon, one of the older brothers, as essentially a hostage, as a prisoner, until you bring back Benjamin, your youngest brother, with you. And so he imprisons Simeon. And the other brothers go back to Israel and say, our brother's imprisoned. We need to bring Benjamin. And Israel is not happy with the idea of sending his youngest son, Benjamin, his new favorite, back to Egypt with them, lest something happen to him like happened to Joseph decades earlier. But finally, they convince their father because they're starving. And they come back with Benjamin. And when Joseph sees Benjamin, he still wants to mess with him a bit, but he starts to crack. He begins to weep in private, seeing his family again, seeing the hurt that they're experiencing. So he invites them in. They have a nice fancy meal with him. They see all the nice stuff that he has. He's kind of showing off how great he has it. And then he sends them away with the grain that they bought, but he hides some of his fancy silverware, his cup, in Benjamin's bags. And then he sends people after them to arrest them. And he says, whoever has my stuff in their bags, they'll become my slave. And the stuff was found in Benjamin's bag, and they bring him back. And he said, well, I'll only let him free if you bring back your father, Israel, to come meet me. And Judah steps up. He's like, well, take me instead. Don't let Benjamin be the hostage, knowing how much it meant to their father. And at this moment, I don't know whether it's the change of heart they see in their brothers, whether it's the willingness to step in for the new favorite, or what it is. But at this moment, Joseph cracks. He begins weeping in front of everyone. And everyone's like, what is going on with this guy? But at that moment, even though he tried to get a bit of a payback for them, imprisonment for imprisonment, slavery for slavery, deception for deception, he can't take it anymore, and he reveals himself to them. And it's interesting the wording that he uses. Finally, in Genesis 45, we read of him revealing himself to his brothers. This is on page 39 of your storybook. Genesis 45, verse 3 and onward. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. He continues on and says something similar after they're afraid. Once Israel dies, they think he's going to get more payback on them. But he says in chapter 50, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. There's a deep wisdom to this that Joseph begins to realize. And I don't know if we always grasp it. Joseph looks back at his story over the years of being attacked and sold into slavery, of being falsely accused for sexual assault and serving 2 years in prison that he didn't deserve. And he looks back and he says, don't be angry at yourselves, because God has been with me and has actually been using this pain in my life, this rough road that I've been walking, for his purpose. He realizes in the midst of the evil intentions of others that God intended for these moments in his life to happen so that something greater can come about. Like a whole part of the world was able to be sustained because of God using him to interpret Pharaoh's dream and rationing the grain during 7 years of devastating famine. The name of God was honored by Pharaoh himself as he acknowledged that it was God who helped Joseph interpret his dream. And ultimately, what this would lead to is Joseph inviting his whole family to live in Egypt with him, and the opportunity for God's promised people, the nation of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, to flourish in Egypt, to grow, to expand, to have their own city of Goshen that they live and flourish in for a good time. Joseph was able to step back and look at the ups and the downs of his story in light of God's bigger story of what he's doing. God knew the famine was coming. God knew that neither Egypt nor his promised covenant people, Abraham's descendants, would survive the 7 years of devastating famine. And so he used Joseph's story of pain, of getting the short end of the stick time after time, for his greater purpose, saving the nations and bringing glory to his name. Here's the thing with this. We need to take a step back and look at our story in light of God's greater story of what he's doing, to see that even the hurtful parts in our lives, the moments of pain and of struggle, and how they might be part of God's grand sovereign story that he is writing and weaving through our lives. And this isn't easy to hear, I realize. But at the same time, it can be incredibly comforting that nothing in this world, nothing takes place, the beautiful and the painful, none of it is a surprise to God. God isn't reacting to what's going on in the world. He's actually somehow working through it. What is often done and intended for evil, God has worked through and is using it, and sometimes even intending it for good. Now, it's usually not until in retrospect that we see this. It's not until looking back years later, usually, that we can say, okay, in this season of my life, God was working. God was with me. Like, do you think that Joseph, when he was spending 2 years in an Egyptian prison, thought, like, this is just part of God's bigger picture? Like, it sounds trite when you talk about it that way. But once he's involved in saving Egypt and his brother's family and sees how God has used him, he can look back and say, I wouldn't be here right now if God hadn't have brought me through that. If it wasn't for slavery and for imprisonment, I wouldn't be here as the deputy to Pharaoh in Egypt, able to save thousands of lives. We may never see the whole purpose of our suffering. We may not have a moment like Joseph where we can say, oh, this is the big climax of what's going on, and we can look back and say, all right, I can see the storyline. Not on this side of eternity, at least. But here's something we can trust in, something that we can put our hope in. As God spoke through the Apostle Paul, he said in Romans 8, verse 28, this is not actually in your storybook. He says, and we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. You may notice this is our memory verse this week, by the way. Let's read it aloud together. I'm going to stand by the side so you can read the screen. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. You may want to grab a pen and just write the reference in the margins of your book or something. We're using the NIV version if you want to memorize that this week to come back for next week. But here's the thing. We're not just picking that as the memory verse for no reason. This is a promise to us as followers of Christ that our story is being weaved together by God for our good. The good, the bad, and the ugly for our good. God promised to be faithful to Abraham, and he remained faithful. God promises to work for our ultimate good, and he will. The thing is, our good doesn't always look like what we want our good to look like. As a kid, we always want to grab a cookie from the cookie jar, right? Like our idea of good is I can get a cookie whenever I want. But as a parent, I'm not a parent, but as parents, you know, it's probably not the best idea for your kid to have a cookie every time they want a cookie. That sometimes the good for your kid is broccoli instead of cookie. Our good isn't always what we see as our good, but in the long run, God is weaving things together. The good and the bad, the cookies and the broccoli, for what is ultimately best for us. Maybe you're enduring pain right now. Maybe you're in the midst of a season of life where you're just struggling. I know it's hard to hear, but take comfort that just like as Joseph was enslaved and imprisoned, God was there with him. God was with him and gave him favor with the jailer. God was with him and gave him favor with Potiphar. God is not going to leave your side in the midst of those moments. He will bring you through them, through to the other side, and weave it together as part of your good. For Joseph, it was to be able to save the lives of thousands. For you, God could be doing amazing things that you won't be able to see until later. ultimately we see God weaving this together as part of his grander upper story of restoring his fallen world to himself. And you remember Joseph's dream that he had, that his brothers would bow down before him, that his father and mother, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars would bow down before him. There's something interesting that we read at the end of the book of Genesis, where Israel, his dad, he blesses each one of his 12 sons. He spends time blessing each one. And it's interesting that as he prophetically blesses his son Judah, not Joseph, he says, your brothers will bow before you. The sons of your father will bow before you, and the scepter will not leave your line. It's from the line of Judah that we see the line of kings that Jesus comes from. The one who would come and, similar to Joseph, would be betrayed and suffer, but for the good of the nations. He would be betrayed and suffer to save the very ones who betrayed him. Really, Joseph and his dream are pointing us to the greater Joseph, the one who would come, the Messiah, to whom all his brothers, all nations would one day bow, who endured suffering but was ultimately exalted. It's Christ that all this points to. The fact that he suffered and his body was broken and his blood was spilled out for our good. We're going to, in a few minutes, celebrate the Lord's Supper in a very tangible way, remembering Christ's body broken and his blood spilled out for us. But remember that God worked for your ultimate good in sending his son. One that we see hints of even in the first book of the Bible. That God's story is being weaved together to save the nations, to be faithful to his covenant people, and to bring glory to his name. Let's pray. God, we thank you that you have proved yourself faithful, that you use even the moments of suffering and pain, as well as the moments of flourishing and good, for our good. Lord, I pray for those of us who are in seasons right now where it is suffering and pain, and this might be hard to hear. God, I pray that you would be especially close to them right now, that you would show them your presence with them, your provision for them, and how you are weaving this together as part of your grander story of salvation of the world and for their good. Lord, you're not going to leave us alone. We thank you for that. And God, we thank you that we see the ultimate picture of your commitment to us by sending Christ to die on our behalf, to suffer, to save the nations. Lord, as we move into this time of communion, as we sing and worship together, Lord, be among us. Make us people centered on Christ. It's in his name we pray. Amen.